Weekly Cop Watch, a project of Grassroots House. And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 1 p.m. Stay tuned next for Project Censored.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today, with guest co-host Ken Burrows from San Francisco State University. On today's program, we look at the plot to kill King, the truth behind the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., which is also the title of the latest book from national best-selling author Dr. William Pepper. William Pepper joins us for the program today to talk about his most recent book, On the Plot to Kill King, just after the 49th anniversary of that historic event. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, with special guest co-host Ken Burrows from San Francisco State University. On today's program, we have the distinct pleasure of joining in conversation with the national best-selling author, Dr. William F. Pepper. William Pepper is a human rights lawyer most known for his defense of James Earl Ray in the trial for the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. and of Sirhan Sirhan in the trial for the murder of Senator Robert Kennedy. Pepper is the author of An Act of State and Orders to Kill. He has been active in government cases, including the 9/11 Truth Movement, and in attempts to charge George W. Bush with war crimes. He was appointed a barrister of the United Kingdom, but now primarily resides in New York. His latest book on Skyhorse is called The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And William Pepper, you join us today by phone. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Mickey and Ken.
So Ken Burrows, get the conversation going for us.
Hello, Bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Ken.
You bet. So just to get us rolling here, let's start with your connection with Dr. King. How and when did you first come to meet Dr. King? And really, what sort of a man did you find him to be?
Well, I only knew Martin King the last year of his life, and I met him in early 1967 as a result of him having read and apparently been deeply moved by my piece in Ramparts magazine in January of 67 called The Children of Vietnam. So he had asked me to meet with him and discuss the horrors and the war crimes that I encountered in Vietnam when I was there as a journalist. And I did that. Then he asked me to stay with him as long as possible, work with him as much as possible on the formation of what we came to call the National Conference for New Politics. It was an umbrella organization designed to bring together peace and freedom entities from all over the country under one roof for the purpose of opposing the war, but also but beginning to deal with the issues of economic injustice. He was increasingly concerned about the impoverishment of large numbers of Americans and wanted to go into that area as well. Neither of these topics, the war or the economy, endeared him to the ruling forces of American society. And indeed, not only did it not endear him, but they came to have contempt and disdain for him. When he delivered his anti-war speech at Riverside Church on the 4th of April, 1967, 1 year to the day of his death, the next day he was condemned across the country by virtually every newspaper, and even members of his own civil rights movement and various groups there criticized him, condemned him. In some instances, he was called a traitor. So I came in to meet him at that period of time as a result of his evolutionary development with respect to seeing the links between war and poverty as it affected not only Native Americans, Mexican Americans, Appalachian whites, and Southern blacks, but as it affected all of the poor people of the world. So he was growing, and I came upon him at that point in time. Now, what kind of a man was he? A man of enormous courage. No matter how much money it cost him, his organization, no matter how much his life became increasingly endangered, he stood firm on behalf of values that he thought were essential, human values. And he thought to be silent in the face of this type of criminality, war criminality in particular, was in fact unconscionable. So he was a man of enormous courage, depth, and integrity, and determined to have an impact on the structure of American democracy.
And so part of what you may have been talking about is organizing the Poor People's Campaign, is that right? And also, how did you influence his anti-war position, and what was your relationship with King during that time?
Well, the Poor People's Campaign was very much developed during that point in time, but it had been an idea of his that was generated somewhat before in 1966. But it related to the economic issues that I just mentioned. With respect to the war, I was traumatized personally by the amount of devastation and brutality and slaughter that I saw over there, and tried to convey that in the Ramparts piece. And when I showed him, opened to him the rest of my files I had developed, he openly wept. We were on the way to open Vietnam Summer in Cambridge, Massachusetts, following a sermon of his at the Brown University Chapel, and that's where I met him for the first time. I waited until he came out, and then we rode together. And he wept when he saw what his government was doing to this ancient, beautiful people. So he was deeply moved and determined, at great risk, not just monetary risk, but great physical risk, to stand against that war.
Could you summarize his conclusions that you've reached, or your conclusions that you reached regarding his assassination? What led up to that?
Well, they had determined that they were going to kill him because of the two issues we've just been discussing. The war was a very important monetary issue for major American corporations. You know, at one point, John Downey, who was head of the Military Intelligence Group, the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, used to brief Johnson, President Johnson, on a very regular basis. And every time he would come back from Vietnam, he would brief the president, and he would ask him, why are we there? Why are we losing blood and treasure? What's behind all of this? What is the reason for it? It doesn't make any sense. And Johnson would ignore him for the most part. And then finally one day, I guess he'd had too much or whatever, he pounded the table and he said, John, I can't get out of Vietnam. My friends are making too much money. So that, to me, says it all in terms of the reason for waging war. It was corporate interests, okay? That was very important. So the war was a very important reason for wanting to get rid of him. But the Poor People's Campaign, in my view, is probably the major reason, because he was going to bring 500,000 people to the nation's capital, and they were going to camp there. They were going to go visit their elected representatives, and they were going to try to get agreement to turn the funds back again to programs of social welfare and social justice. And the military and the powers that be believed that was not going to work, of course. They were not going to affect that type of budgetary change. And because of that, they believed if that 500,000 people that Martin was going to bring would get more angry, and that their resistance would lead into open rebellion. And they didn't believe they had the forces to put down the rebellion on the streets of Washington. So he was never going to be ultimately allowed to bring that mass of Americans to Washington, D.C. And that was why they were going to have to get rid of him. And Memphis, of course, was the place that was selected. Sanitation workers' strike was used for the purpose of getting him into Memphis, and he was there assassinated.
I'd like to remind listeners, this is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, and I'm in studio with Ken Burrows, who is co-hosting with me today. We're in conversation with Dr. William F. Pepper, and his most recent book is The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And here we are, just past the 49th anniversary of the assassination of King. And William Pepper, you were just talking specifically about not only the issues of foreign policy and imperialism, and certainly the reason that a lot of people seem to generically go back to King in terms of race and racial injustice, but also, you know, his tying in of blacks and sort of the intersectionality of what he began to seriously represent through 1967 and then 1968. This is what you're saying is ultimately what's luring him to Memphis for the sanitation strike. And you keep saying they are luring him and this was a decision that was made to kill him. So I know you've talked about this certainly in your other book, Act of State, and in your new book, The Plot to Kill King, which contains many, many of the primary documents and historical documents. And I urge people to see your recent book, The Plot to Kill King, Skyhorse Publishing. But can you talk a little bit more about who are they and what are these forces that are luring him there? Can you be a little bit more specific about that? And I certainly know your book does that.
Yeah, sure. In a broad overall sense, when I refer to they, I'm talking about really basically the ruling forces of the corporate structure in America. And I'm speaking specifically about the finance houses and banks, major energy and oil corporations, all of whom have enormous power and try to exercise that in terms of public policy. Now, in terms of specifics as to who was involved, they're foot soldiers. When I identify these forces as ruling forces, their foot soldiers are agencies of government of the United States. And in the case of the assassination of Martin King, the primary agency that led the way was the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover would send Clyde Tolson, his number two, into Memphis on a very regular basis. Tolson would come in. He would meet with the local Southern Mafia groups, mainly headed by the Adkins family, and they would begin to set up the details for the actual assassination. Tolson would also bring money in from Hoover, and that money would be put in paper bags with names on it of people who had jobs to do with respect to the assassination. So it was paying as well as giving instructions. They were organizing things on the ground with what we have come to call the Dixie Mafia. Now, when it came to James Earl Ray, he had been profiled earlier as a convict of Jefferson City prison who would be likely to be a very good candidate for being a patsy in a case of this sort. So they organized James's escape. $25,000 was brought in by Tolson. It was carried to the warden of the prison by old man Adkins and his son, Ron. And it was Ron who became one of our witnesses who revealed to us everything that was going on. He rode to the prison with the money and his father. They paid off the warden. The warden organized James's escape. James was allowed to escape in April of 1967. And then he was kept on a string. They had a handler. They kept him on a string and moved him around the country. Initially, Martin King was to have been killed in Los Angeles. They had two army snipers and their spotters in Los Angeles. They were there for quite a period of time, and they kept James there for quite a period of time. Eventually, quickly, a decision was made to move them out and into the South, and that was when they designated Memphis as the scene of the assassination. And I wondered for a long time why they didn't go through with it in Los Angeles, and then I came to realize that there was another assassination that was being planned for Los Angeles following the California primary. And that, of course, took place a couple of months later, and Bob Kennedy was hit in Los Angeles. It would not do to have two major assassinations in the same city. So Martin's death was to be taken in Memphis. So that's the organizing up to the point of when he was actually shot. He was there to help the striking sanitation workers, and that was a part of his concern about economic injustice. And so he was there to help them and be victorious in terms of their strike. And then he was going to leave Memphis and begin the trek for the Poor People's March and encampment in Washington.
William Pepper, I know this is an aside, and I don't want to get too off the trail here, though I do think that this is entirely relevant when you brought up the Robert Kennedy assassination. Of course, you have been very active involved in the Sirhan Sirhan case, and we talked about that the last time you were on the Project Censored show. But can you talk about what is the nexus here, if any, between RFK and MLK and their assassinations in this historic year of 1968?
Well, the nexus is they were really on the same page in terms of opposing the war in Vietnam. And Bob Kennedy had become aware of the economic plight of millions and millions of Americans and was determined to do something about that. He also, of course, was determined to reopen the investigation into the assassination of his brother. So that was another issue that was aside to the nexus between him and Martin King. Martin and Bobby were very close in terms of concern for the impoverished Americans and also in terms of the war. And they were building a joint following across the country that was bound to have an impact, and they really were not going to be allowed to do that. There even was some discussion that Bobby, when running for president of the United States, might have reached out, and there were some discussions about this, reached out and tried to take Martin King on as a running mate. So that they could even have broadened the relationship that much closer together. But that, of course, never got to fruition.
We're speaking with Dr. William Pepper, author most recently of The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. We'll continue our conversation with William Pepper after this musical break. Please stay with us.
Met Dr. King, who read his war reporting on Viet children's suffering. Martin asked young William Pepper to speak about the war, to come to his congregation, and they were friends forevermore. Then William went to law school, put his talents to the task, to fight for social justice, to answer questions we must ask. It was April 4, 1968, when Martin Luther King was murdered in the broad daylight. It was a devastating thing. There was a mighty rush to judgment, to blame it on James Earl Ray. There was agreement in the government to tell the media what to say. The media called it a crime of hate, a lone nut simple thing. Now we know it was an act of state, the execution of Dr. King. James Earl Ray was just a Nazi, an escaped prisoner for sure, with a top security identity for the whole 9 months before. Some rogues within the government shielded James's Eric Galt, him a car, the driver's license to secure him till the assault, to protect this petty criminal, to put the patsy into place. His handlers sent him to Memphis, where like a pawn he showed his face. Well, Martin marched for civil rights, and he stood against all war. He spoke for truth and justice and nonviolence for sure. When Martin stood with the workers in solidarity with the poor, that high-class oligarchy hated Martin, that's for sure. Earl Clark was one of Memphis cops meeting at Lloyd Jower's grill. across from the Lorraine Motel where Dr. King was killed. Two military sniper teams would have also fired if the police team from Memphis failed to do what was required. Next day, cops cleaned the crime scene, hauled the brush and the proof away. They avoided all the witnesses that might have some truth to say. Too many unanswered questions still blowing in the wind in a murder investigation so deliberately ruined. Too many disturbing answers still came out in the trial, enough to prove conspiracy to a nation in denial. Six white and six black jurors unanimously agreed. The facts present at the trial proved who really did the deed. Yes, it all came out in trial, that in 99 they won, when the government was convicted of the conspiracy they done. William Pepper was a lawyer who won the case in court, but when he went to the press conference, no reporters came to report. So here's to William Pepper, King family, brave, wise, for standing for the truth for us, for overcoming all the lies. William Pepper, keep on struggling, you know you're following the teachings and the vision and the dream of Dr. King. William Pepper wrote a book about the trial and everything, an act of state, the execution of Martin Luther King. An act of state, the execution of Martin Luther King.
And that was the music of Vic Sadeau, the Truth Troubadour, who is here in Berkeley, California, where we broadcast the Project Censored show every week. Vic Sadeau, and that was his song called An Act of State, based on the same title of William Pepper's book about Martin Luther King's assassination. And, of course, this is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with special guest co-host Ken Burroughs, San Francisco State University. And we're talking with the author, William Pepper, about his most recent book on the King assassination, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. We continue our conversation with William Pepper now. Ken, you have the next question for William Pepper.
Bill, wondering how is it that the King family came to work with you in a decade-long effort to really find the real killers of Dr. King, and what led up to the trial that happened in 1999? Can you give us a bit of a historic background?
Sure. The King family was familiar with my work going back before the first book, Orders to Kill. Orders to Kill was published in 1995. They knew that I was quietly gathering evidence and working on the case. I did not involve them, did not brief them, did not try to bring them in. Martin's nephew, Isaac Farris, read Orders to Kill, and he reached out to me and asked me to meet with the family. And I did that in, I guess, 1996. They were moved by what we learned at that point in time, which, remember, is many years ago. But what we learned at that point in time moved them, and so they wanted to pursue it, and they supported a trial for James Earl Ray, which, of course, was not going to happen, and they tried to get Bill Clinton to agree to conduct an investigation. He appointed Janet Reno, his attorney general, to be in charge of that investigation, and it really just, of course, turned out to be a complete whitewash. With this kind of frustration, I suggested that maybe what we should do is actually file a civil action against one of the people whom we knew and who had admitted being involved, Lloyd Jowers. They agreed. We filed a civil action in Memphis, and the trial went on for 30 days.
And this is the civil trial. This is the King v. Jowers in 1999.
Yes, that's right. King v. Jowers civil trial. Put on for 30 days with some 70 witnesses. Was not covered by the media. The media just stayed away. Court TV at first was, oh, yes, this is something we have to cover. Well, they were told not to think about it. So because of the degree of media control in matters of this sort, very few people know that trial took place. But it did, and it took a jury 59 minutes to find that James Earl Ray had no involvement, knowing involvement in the killing, and agents of the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, city of Memphis did. And so that was the result of the civil trial. And the King family believed when that happened that we had closure and they had closure. And I was very pleased about that. But of course, between 1999 and 2016, when the final book, The Plot to Kill King, was released, we acquired an enormous amount of additional evidence and information about the assassination, how it took place, how King was actually killed, which is very important. And that, as far as I'm concerned now, is closure. Coretta has died, but three of the children are alive. Yolanda also died, but three of the children are alive.
Bill, can you speak to more how King actually died, his actual death versus the way we've been told he died in the media?
He was shot from the bushes in the back of the rooming house by a Memphis Police Department sharpshooter. He was hit in the face and went down and lost consciousness. He was, however, alive. He was taken to St. Joseph's Hospital. He was in the emergency room. They were working on him in the emergency room. The chief of neurosurgery, the head neurosurgeon, doctor named Breen Bland, B-L-A-N-D, who was also the family doctor for the Dixie Mafia family, the Adkins family, came in with two men in suits and told the people, stop working on that nigger, get out and just let him die.
And that's a quote that you got during deposition?
That's an actual quote, yeah.
And that's in the book. That's actually in the appendix of one of the appendices in The Plot to Kill King. You have the transcript of that.
Yeah. What I have insisted on doing is I insisted on putting in the complete text of all of the relevant transcripts, depositions, mm-hmm. all of them, so that I can't be accused of taking things out of context or making them up. The actual depositions, the statements sworn under oath are there. So Bland said to this emergency room group that were working on King to get out of there. Stop working, that was the quote, stop working on that nigger, just let him die and get out. And he threw them all out of the room. The last one to leave the room was a surgical nurse. Her name was Shelby. And as she was leaving, she heard them gathering spit up in their mouths like this. And that caught her attention, so she turned around, looked over her shoulder. And then she saw them spit on the body of Dr. King, saw Dr. Bland pull out the catheter and take a pillow and put the pillow over his face and suffocate him. Now, he might have died anyway from his wounds. It was a severe wound. But nevertheless, he was still alive. And they were not going to take any chances that he might survive.
And William Pepper, now, just to be clear, this was information presented in the trial to the jury?
No.
Right.
No,
okay. No. So that's what I'm trying to get at here. So
yes,
this is what I'm getting at, because a lot of people, like you mentioned earlier, that's why I just wanted to clarify that sure. was not the case, because most people are still not aware of this 1999 trial.
I know.
Number one. And the media did a splendid job of ignoring it and covering it up.
and why is that the case, Bill? Why do you think the progressive media, including progressive media, has just failed to cover this? Can you speak to that issue?
Well, of course, the corporate media refuses, because the corporate media is controlled basically by the ruling moneyed forces of the society, who want to keep the people calm, who don't want them to be anxious, who don't want them to lose confidence in their government, don't want them to be in any way to question the credibility of the agencies of government who are paid so much money in their budgets every year. So that's true with respect to the corporate media. One, they've really pretty much now buttoned down, controlled the corporate media on cases of this sort. when it comes to progressive media, they also have had ways of compromising progressive media. And so it's great disappointment that a lot of our progressive media people simply will not deal with this, will not deal with this kind of case or this kind of issue. Now, why is that? Well, progressive media entities often are recipients of grants and awards from entities like the Ford Foundation, and that's CIA money for the most part. So they're not going to risk losing that. They don't want to cover this, and they don't cover it. Let's face it. It's only for chaps like you at KPFA.
Certainly at Project Censored, we have a deep interest in this. My co-host and associate, Dr. Peter Phillips, actually teaches a course that uses your Act of State book in it, in a sociology of conspiracy class that looks at historical conspiracy fact and looks how it challenges dominant narratives. So you're certainly on the right program as far as that issue goes. But William Pepper, given that this didn't come out in the trial, could you explain to the listeners how you got this information and how you got this deposition and why you then included it in the book?
After the trial, there became, just as after an HBO Thames Television mock trial back in 92, people started to become more aware of what was going on, and some people who had vital information were approaching the graves and wanted to share it. So people came forward. One of the people who came forward was the son of the surgical nurse. His name was Jonathan Shelby. And Jonathan went into deposition with us and laid out everything the mother told them the next morning when she came home. She gathered them in the parlor and she said, "I just still don't understand why they had to kill him." And then she explained what she saw and what she heard in the emergency room. So Jonathan talked about that in detail. Then the son of the Dixie Mafia leader, Adkins, who had sat in on so many meetings with his father and who knew Tolson very well and talked about Tolson's coming in continually, he came forward and agreed to go under oath. And over many hours, I think upwards of 11 hours, I deposed Ron Tyler Adkins and gave him all the opportunity that he needed to tell everything that he knew. So that we started to get this information. We started to get it well after 1999. We got it into 2010, 11, 12, 13.
And so this is the reason for this other book then. This is after, yeah, Act of State, because you uncovered some of this. You had revealed some of these things in the Act of State book, but then you discovered so much more since.
Yes, that's right. This was the final book, and for me, it's the end of the story. There is really nothing more that I can do or say or expect to learn. I've been on this for about 40 years, and that's what it's taken to slowly get to the bottom of what really happened to Dr. King.
And in your mind, what's the difference between the 99 jury verdict and your conclusions in the plot to kill King?
They're the same. I mean, in the sense that the jury found that agents of the government, three governments, federal, state, and local, were responsible for the killing of Martin King. And as we worked on this, we got more definitive information, more specific information, so we were able to name the people. We were able to name the people who were involved in the actual killing.
Can you name them here?
Sure. I had lunch with the shooter. His name is Frank Strouser. He's still alive. He was the one who pulled the trigger that hit Martin and knocked him down. So Strouser was the shooter. His spotter was another Memphis police officer called Earl Clark. Frank Holloman, who was the head of police and fire in Memphis and who had worked for a number of years in Hoover's office in Washington. Basically, it's emerged that he was the real on-the-ground coordinator after Russell Adkins died. It was Holloman who actually organized things on the ground. Frank Liberto, a mafioso, who worked with the Memphis Police Department, organized the shooting. I couldn't name Strouser for a number of years because the man who gave me his information was a janitor at the police firing range in Memphis, and he observed Strasser preparing the entire day, firing a specially delivered rifle, and then leaving at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He gave us a lot of detailed information. I couldn't reveal it because I was afraid they would kill him. So I had to hold on to that segment of information for a number of years. Lenny Curtis was his name, brave man. And we just waited. Finally, Lenny died, and we were able to use his deposition. We had a filmed and a transcribed deposition. So that was very important in terms of nailing the shooter, although the shooter didn't kill him. And the killing was by this Dr. Bland. And Ron Tyler, the Adkins boy, was present when Bland said to his father, if he's not killed with the shot, be sure he gets to my hospital so we can make sure that he doesn't leave there alive. That's how we built up this information in later years.
Thank you. It's very clear, Bill. And thank you for your good work all these years, just to acknowledge that. We thought of closing our interview. We're getting close to this now. Just the thought about Dr. King being a moral voice of our time. And if he were alive today, what advice do you think he would give us?
I think he would say, keep your powder dry and your values steadfast and your heart always going in the right direction. I think he would say, patience is required. This system is headed toward an enormous change, and the light will soon become brighter and brighter. But you must, as a part of your resistance, you must stay firm in terms of values and also in terms of determination. I believe that's what he would say.
William Pepper, you write in the preface of your book, you say that your work, which began 9 years after the assassination, continued to the present, has resulted in two books, 1995, 2003, and then, of course, this one, The Plot to Kill King, in 2016. So this is what you call your culminating work, the final work on this topic for you. The book pulls all of the previous work together, leading up to a revelation of the most devastatingly depressive final act in the life of this much-loved man. And you go on to say, due to the absence of any courage by the mainstream corporate media, the disinformers have largely been successful in keeping the truth buried. Even today, they persist. And yet, you have the courage to lay all of this out in The Plot to Kill King for all to see.
Well, we try to do the best we can, but whatever I can do in terms of manifestation of courage is just a mere shadow of Martin King's presence and life work and the debt that I feel we all owe to him.
Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome, guys. Thanks so much for your continued interest and your help wherever you can give it.
Dr. William Pepper, thank you so much for coming back on the Project Censored Show. Your latest book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., out on Skyhorse Publishing. Thank you so much, Bill Pepper, for all of your work and for coming on the program today. After this brief musical break, we'll return to the Project Censored Show, where I'll be talking to our guest co-host Ken Burroughs, who has for many years run a program at San Francisco State University, Gandhi King, Seasons of Nonviolence. So please stay with us.
What is it about Birmingham? What is it about Buffalo that the hay-filled water-filled bunkers in your beautiful red earth, they want to build them in our shiny white snow? And now I've drawn the curtain, the booth where the truth has no place. Standing, I am feeling so powerless in this stupid booth with this useless little lever in my hand. And outside, my city is bracing for the next killing thing, standing by the bridge and praying.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. Today, I'm Mickey Huff with Ken Burrows. Earlier in the program, we were in conversation with the best-selling author William Pepper about his most recent book, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And Ken Burrows, you have certainly known William Pepper for some time. You've interviewed him yourself, and you run an entire speaker series every winter into spring at San Francisco State University on Gandhi to King, Seasons of Nonviolence. And you've been on the Project Censored Show before to talk about that. But let's remind listeners, what exactly is this that you do at San Francisco State University? Because it is something that's also open to the public, many of the events. And also, you know, comment on what, you know, how you got there. What drew you to doing this? Because it's an amazing series of events you put on every year. Ken?
Well, the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence actually occurs between the assassination dates of Gandhi, which was January 30th, and King's assassination, which we just passed, April 4th. That's a 64-day period, 9 weeks. And within those 9 weeks, this originated actually because of an interfaith series of churches, a coalition of churches, who wondered how we can take the principles of nonviolence, which we'll talk about in just a moment, that King and Gandhi were exemplars of, and a new type of activism that Gandhi and King and Cesar Chavez and others that followed in their footsteps. How do we talk about kind of activism versus just simply the blaming and shaming that often goes on with conventional activism that's really all about resistance but really doesn't necessarily talk about the greater good and the integrative healing aspects that need to go on within the culture as well? So their lives as examples of loving and socially just leaders, their family stepped in, and with these interfaith churches, it was claimed this season is claimed every year between their memorial dates as a time of practicing how to live a life that's more loving, or should say lives that are more loving, more meaningful, and less violent. And so we've had our own way of practicing this, as our other faith and academic communities throughout the country. So there'll be institutions, whether they be at a university or a church or a nonprofit, that are also hosting their own versions of using this educational era, these 9 weeks, to begin to think about what our culture is about currently and the violence within our culture, and to begin to have very clear alternatives to that violence, and to look at that the way we host it anyway, within three segments. The first 3 weeks of this series is the 3 weeks we focus on our inner life. What can I do about my own thoughts, my own emotional reactivity, my own sense of really being violent and less loving in my life? That's my practice, those first 3 weeks. And everyone is invited into this. The second 3 weeks are about my relationships with others, my significant relationships with the people I care the most about. How do I really deepen those relationships and learn the difficult challenges that come in relationship about how to be more connected and more relational with each other in ways that are constructive? In the last 3 weeks, we focus on our relationships with the world. How do I acknowledge my life as political and societal, and how do I respect my efforts toward the common good? So that's a general frame.
You're combining certainly the teachings of nonviolence, and certainly people like Gandhi and King certainly are among some of the folks that definitely come to mind in the 20th century. When you were saying that, I wanted to also give an opportunity here for you to talk a little bit more specifically up to date, because you run this speaker series and you invite many different people to come in. I know I've actually been in talking about Project Censored during some of the same time period that you've done this. But who are the current voices for nonviolence that you are plugged into that you think are really carrying this mission into the 21st century?
That's a great question. Well, again, each of these dimensions, the self, others, and world, or earth, if you will, we acknowledge there will be leaders within each of these dimensions of our lives. So those that have psychological practices that support this, and those that have social practices, and, of course, those that are more political in orientation. So when I think of the psychological work, I think right away of Gandhi, who started this thing, recognizing we need a way to be in the world that is not just likely to cause harm to ourselves and to a system, but just understand what nonviolence is. That very kind of activism that has psychological roots within it has to do with respecting that everyone, including the opponent, and that your activism is really something that is in a way to convert your opponent to understand a bigger picture of what's going on, so that nonviolence is not just about not being violent. It's about principled nonviolence. It's about revealing injustice wherever it is by refusing to go along with it. So the emotional and psychological costs that come with standing up to injustice, you have to prepare for this. You have to do the psychological work to be able to engage in the more activistic revelations that come with being willing to take on the upset of the opponent who might not want to be outed by your behavior. So that whole psychological work is not just for you. It leads into the second and third steps of the season as well. When I think of the second part of the season, I think of nonviolent communication, everybody learning how to communicate in ways that are more need-based and less reactive. And when we are reactive, when we become reactive, we use those moments with those we care about as teaching opportunities to really learn how to relate to each other more deeply. So really valuing conflict. Gandhi said it very simply. Conflict reveals. Conflict always teaches if you're willing. So entering there, there's sociocracy practices are really changing the nature of groups right now. How do we establish not just consensus circles, but collaborative groups within circles that help us become more efficient and not just get lost in this constant litany and discussion period of consensus? And so there's this evolution going on within the small groups. And then finally, the last segment, which is more about the politics. That's where we might even spend a little bit more time if you want to extend.
Yeah, actually, let's do that. And again, feel free to name some of the people that you think are more current manifestations of this. It's something that Daniel Ellsberg, he wrote an essay for us a few years ago in Censored 2014, and he was specifically speaking about whistleblowers and Chelsea Manning and others, but he used the phrase civil courage.
Yes.
Now, you're kind of segueing into politics here, and that's really kind of what we're looking at with whether it's a Gandhi or a King or a Manning or a Snowden or a Sybil Edmonds or Colleen Rowley around 9/11. And whistleblowers often get a bad rap. Often the criticism is that, well, they want to be the center of attention. And the irony of that is that all the whistleblowers I just named, they specifically said the opposite. In fact, they kind of just were thrown into the maelstrom, and it's as if they were trying to catch up to themselves. They were already there trying to, quote, do the right thing, and they had to kind of catch up to themselves to realize what did I get myself into here? Because there are great and dire consequences for speaking such truths and revealing such information, particularly in a place like the United States, where we have the illusions of democracy and transparency, right?
So Gandhi called satyagraha the willingness to be the truth and to trust truth, that by revealing truth, the larger truth of asaya and injustice, you have to expect there will be repercussions of the established order. They will resist that revelation, and they will resist you in your expression of it. And yet, that is what a whistleblower does. That is what any of us would do if that principle is to be honored, is that you express it.
And that's what William Pepper has been doing for 40 years.
His whole life is literally this, and three books expressing this, trying to just to get people to be aware of this. And yet, still most of us aren't. So to be a nonviolent activist is to really be in the game in a way that incurs the insight, the perspective, and that's why media is so important. If the media isn't there observing this, then often your activism cannot be covered and therefore will be buried. And the injustice of the moment becomes an instruction point for the injustice within the system itself as it tries to protect itself against this revelation about truth. That becomes the teaching and the practice of an activist that really sees this. And these are the social justice movements around the world that are lasting. They become sustainable because there isn't one more revolution to protect. It's an evolution of thinking that actually begins to ripple out, and with that, society is informed and becomes protective of this larger understanding. So we spent time at San Francisco State certainly looking at the economy, that the violence of much of our life is structural violence due to the nature of a debt-created currency system, of a banking system, and corporate system where profit is channeled to a few and the masses are left with much less. So the whole metaphor of the top 1% or less than 1% actually really being the owners of the oligarchy is what we've stepped into, and that we're really not a democracy anymore, as a number of studies have indicated. So,
or weren't in the first place.
Yes, but to look at this economic force that is driving all of our lives is a primary piece. So the violence within capitalism and how do we reform and heal that is part of what we do. We always focus on that.
Indeed. And, you know, since you just mentioned media a little bit and we can riff on this, I couldn't help but think, of course, during our conversation with William Pepper of one of my favorite Michael Parenti quotes back in the 90s when Michael had written one of his many, many books, a book called History as Mystery. And in a lot of ways, what we see here with William Pepper is he's kind of the historian, lawyer, detective, also storyteller mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very fascinating to me that one of Parenti's quotes that I always use in classes is that those engaged in the manufacturing of history often introduce distortions at the point of origin well before the history is written or even played out. And this initial process of control is not usually left to chance, but is regularly pursued by interested parties who are situated to manipulate the record. Mm-hmm. And often then journalism functions as the first draft or rough draft of history. Yep. And right out of the gate, you get these spun, partial, erroneous, or even completely disinformative narratives. Mm-hmm. And it's, I guess, hard-pressed to find a better example in that case of what Pepper talks about with the King assassination. Yep. And then, of course, he also talked about it with Sirhan Sirhan and the Kennedy assassination. So the role that journalism plays is so significant in getting the information to people, right? And it's not just a sort of journalism that looks at all of the problems or highlights all of these troublesome or negative things, but it's a different kind of journalism. And I know this is something that you focus on quite a bit, not just solutions journalism, but there's also generative journalism. And there's other ways of approaching the storytelling that doesn't just deconstruct the problem. You want to say a few words about that and what you do with your students?
Certainly, mm-hmm. certainly. Well, propaganda-driven narratives, first of all, are really a poor issue for all of us. So the challenge being that we don't know we're swimming in them and that we're relying on them, and they become literally what we believe. So that's, I think, the main reason we have this season for nonviolence is to begin to clarify a larger narrative and narratives that are more meaningful, again, more loving, more social, and more about how do we construct and create and support the common good. So that said, constructive media, what is that about? And what is a mindful media scholarship and mindful media movement look like? And I would suggest that, yes, solution-based media is important because we all like innovation. We like thinking outside the box and changing the game with something that's more innovative and creative. And yet mindful media is also about really taking it deeper, about really noticing what's truly going on here that you might not have seen before, and noticing something new you haven't been paying attention to, and deepening your narrative and your understanding of this ongoing propaganda swimming pool we're in, and really begin to clarify what this larger story might look like and your place in that.
We're speaking with Ken Burrows. He's a professor at San Francisco State University and actually runs the Holistic Health Center there. Ken Burrows is also on the board of directors at Media Freedom Foundation, has been a longtime contributor to Project Censored, and has certainly been on the Project Censored show many times. And I wanted to thank Ken Burrows and Byron Belitzos for helping set up the program today with William Pepper. And it's important not only that we thank people that are speaking fearlessly, right, in these fateful times, and it's, of course, important to acknowledge places like Skyhorse Publishing, right, for really putting out this 800-page book from Pepper, David Talbot's Hot Books, our publishers at Seven Stories Press that publish our book every year, and these other media outlets like KPFA. And we heard Bill Pepper saying that there are many, many places where we have these platforms where the fish are aware they're swimming in the pool of propaganda, mm-hmm. and they're trying to jump out of that and maybe make a new pool, right? And so we certainly want to celebrate those kinds and those types of media. But just wanted to maybe get some of your final remarks based on your experience with what you do with your students and the Seasons of Nonviolence, and having been in conversation just earlier in the program with William Pepper, how would you summarize your ideas about the conversation we had with Pepper, and what would you hope that listeners should take away from that? Not telling them what they need to take away from it, mm-hmm. but what are some things that you think are important that you'd like people to consider, you know, after listening to some of that very difficult information, painful information mm-hmm. that comes out that reveals so much of the darker shadow side of our culture.
That's a very reflective question and one I would like to set with, but given our limits on time, I'll just speak to that really goodness, truth, and beauty is not something that's foregrounded very much in our media. We have such a reactive culture that we don't often hold space for really noticing the greater good that's really what humanity is about. And this season for nonviolence, just interviewing Bill Pepper, to me, just the goodness of this person that can hold this together for 40 years doing this terrifically challenging work, despite really not getting the wide audience that he deserves, that he can continue to do this work at the depth of his own heart and mind. And the greatness that comes to all of us, I think, when we step into this deeper reservoir of truth and goodness within ourselves and call that out and find each other. That's, I think, the missing piece for many of us, that we're told we need to do this alone, when in fact it's in partnership and in sharing. And the new economy, I think, by the way, just to mention that, is about really deepening the gift and sharing economies. And there's so many new innovations, tool libraries, time banks, many other things that are about, that really are instant ways of gathering community and creating them that would be very different than a commercial-based model of relating to each other. So it has a lot to do with understanding this threefold revolution that King talked about, the personal, the social, and the political, that they all have to be integrated in a way that just give our life more sense and more, if you will, goodness, truth, and beauty as we do it.
It's an honor to show up and celebrate that together. I'd like to thank Ken for being here with us today. I'd also like to thank our guest, Dr. William Pepper. We have a couple of announcements for today. Monday, April 10, will be an International Day of Solidarity with the people of Odessa, Ukraine. Demonstrators are calling for justice for the victims of the May 2014 massacre in Kolikovo Square, where at least 45 people were killed at the hands of right-wing mobs. On April 10 in San Francisco, the United National Anti-War Coalition will hold a protest outside the Ukrainian consulate. The location is 530 Bush Street, and the protest begins at 12 noon. And on Friday, April 14th, the Ecumenical Peace Institute and the Livermore Conversion Project will hold their annual Good Friday vigil outside the Livermore Nuclear Weapons Laboratory. Location is the corner of South Vasco Road and Patterson Pass Road. This starts at 6:45 a.m. Again, that's Friday, April 14th.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own my special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
The Project Censored Show airs on about 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about it, you can go to www.projectcensored.org and click on our radio page. You can follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
Created by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, skies, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse.
Howdy, boys and girls. This is Chris Welch inviting you to join me every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday from 11 a.m. to noon for the Talkies. We'll discuss almost everything, the news, of course, and also theater, music, books, generally what's happening in our own backyard and what we can do about it. Your questions and comments are a vital part of the proceedings. That's the Talkies, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, 11 a.m. to noon on KPFA.
Resistance! Resistance! Resistance!
Activists are shouting that today, like they have for nearly 68 years on our airwaves. The history of KPFA is connected to the history of resistance in America, from the McCarthy hearings to anti-war and civil rights movements.